What's Always Drink the Good Stuff?
It's about food, art, travel, music, culture, lifestyle. It's interesting conversations with interesting people. And yes, sometimes it's even about drinking the good stuff.
Hello, everybody. I met our guest today a long time ago when I first started getting into the wine business. He was one of the first people I met. I consider him a wine educator. Welcome, Ian Brackburn.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome. Thanks for coming in today. I have so many questions to ask you. I want to learn so much about you. Tell us a little bit about yourself to start with, please.
Let's see. I have worked in wine since the early 1990s when I worked in the restaurant world. I graduated from Cal Poly Pomona with my degree in hotel and restaurant management. And in short, I went to Cal Poly Pomona to become an engineer, but really preferred my job at night than the study of becoming an engineer. I was a waiter trying to pay my way through college, and my campus counselor recommended highly that I change my study. So they introduced me to the hospitality courses, and I couldn't even believe that was a direction you could go. You know, they don't tell you these things when you're a kid. And then when I graduated from Cal Poly, I was able to work at Checkers Hotel for some really great people. And they introduced me to the food and beverage department because I thought I would be a hotelier. They put me in food and beverage, and then the top sommelier that they had hired handed me the wine list and said, here, buy these wines. And all of a sudden, wine people started showing up asking for me. I was only 19 at the time, so I was a little over my skis, but I wasn't really in charge of tasting anything. I just received the wine and put it away, and I had just taken a food and beverage cost control project class at Cal Poly, and so they liked what I did at the hotel. They liked it enough that they put me in charge of the wine inventory. But the sommelier did all the ordering and purchasing. And when I did turn 21, I went to work for Joachim Splechal at Patina when it was like the best restaurant in the world. Everybody that worked there at that time has become, you know, either a great restaurateur, chef, something like that. And they kicked my butt on a daily basis. And I learned so much working there. And we opened the greatest wines ever made. And that really took me into like, hey, you know what? This wine thing is really impressive and I've never heard anything about it and I want to learn more. So I started my own website called learnaboutwine.com because you could not take a wine class in Los Angeles back in 1995. It just wasn't a program here. And so I was just basically posting little things that I was learning every day. And then by 97, I started to share those things in some wine classes and tasting experiences. And at the same time, I went to work for a wine company, a big one called Young's Market Company. And then I did a pretty good job there. And one of the wineries I represented hired me to run Southern California for them. And I did a pretty good job for them. And then I got an opportunity to go to work for my dream job, which I was stalking for years to say, hey, remember me. And I got hired by Cobrand to be the next guy that they brought into the company. And they continued to elevate me, made me a state manager for Hawaii, West Coast Key Accounts, Louis Jadot Ambassador, Tattinger Champagne Ambassador. And I worked several states and really enjoyed my time with the great company at Cobrand. But I always had this learnaboutwine.com thing on the side. It was like a little side hustle. And my arrangement with my team was, hey, I'm not here to make any money doing this. You guys take any money we make and split it up. They all wanted to do something fun on the side too. And they just did a great job. And we grew Learn About Wine to the point where in 1995, I left my job at Cobrand and started doing Learn About Wine full time and have never looked back.
You know, and that's when I met you the first time when I was starting to get into the wine business. I remember taking some class on the West Side about you bringing a box of plants and soil.
Oh, yeah.
And smelling them, trying to see what you smell in there, comparing that to the nose of a Syrah or a Cabernet or a Merlot. I remember those going back to early 2000s.
I don't remember that. But
that's what I know you from initially.
That's awesome. That's one of the great things about doing this for so long is that my travels through life, there were people that came to my class, met each other in my class, got married, and now they're sending their children to my class. So
intergenerational. And I remember the first time, it was some kind of blind tasting, one of your sessions. I was so happy that I was able to guess the Syrah right.
All right. That is rewarding. And that's a fun class. I think we call it Palette Builder now.
Okay.
And we still do that every once in a while. And yes, a lot of the... I mean, almost all the content we provide is purely something we, created from scratch at a time where there just wasn't anything like it. And that was part of the fun of it, was to maybe throw it against the wall and see what worked and what we could invent and how much energy we could create around it. And we've had some terrible failures and we've had some amazing successes.
Wow, it goes hand in hand, so we just have to learn from them. And I remember you telling the story how you could have bought the domain wine.com, but you bought the domain learnaboutwine.com.
Yeah, I could have had about.com, learn.com, wine.com. All of those became mega businesses, and Learn About Wine, though, was the choice. And what was crazy about that is my stepfather was an engineer, and he told me, whatever I do, make sure I start a website, because you're not going to believe what this website thing is going to become. And that really got planted early. And so that's why we were actually the very first wine education website. And I've been testing that statement for 25 years. There weren't any wine education websites back in 1995, January. January 3rd, in fact. So
that's good advice. I consider you as a wine educator.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you describe yourself?
Bipolar? No. I think of myself as, I'm passionate about wine education. There are always people that know more than you. But I have been able to learn through doing and traveling and tasting to a point where I started making my own wine. I studied for the Master of Wine, did not pass the exam, but let it really sink in just how hard that test is. Yes. And I have a thirst for wine education and seeing how it changes people. So I think a wine educator is a good name. Maybe I think the category is edutainment, though, because I'm not just teaching people like a class teacher, but I'm entertaining people. And I like the entertainer side of that a little bit. It comes from my family background.
What does Learn About Wine do right now? Not how it started, but right now.
Yeah, I mean, it evolved for sure. You know, we went from teaching how old was I? It was like, young man, maybe late 20s, mid-20s, late 20s. And my audience was probably similar age at that point. So we, tippy-toed into the shallow end of the pool. And now I think we're swimming at the deep end of the pool. And that's just because the world has changed. I've changed. My customers have grown up. And we're all looking to, press up against the edge and say, let's test new boundaries. So I think that's what we're doing now. We're creating iconic winemaker dinner or wine event, wine dinners, wine tastings, traveling hard. We're not on a cruise ship taking a crew, 100 people to a winery in a bus. There's 10 of us. And literally one of our trips was to Greece. We drove almost all of Greece.
Wow.
And talk about places untraveled, you know, we really explored, and I love that. I love eating, you know, in grandma's restaurants and finding the, you know, not the touristic places that you might see at the head of a website, but, you know, finding the place where the real locals celebrate. And that's my partner, my wife, Alice, that's her passion, is to discover those things. And she literally for fun digs on the internet to find these places. And if you open up her Google Maps, I don't know if anybody has more stars on their Google map than my wife does in the world. I think Google probably sits back and says, this is the extreme example right here. So we know where we're going to go, you know, 5 years from now because of her research. So yeah, we're pushing boundaries. And I think that's what we're doing, you know, at Learn About Wine at this time, is finding out what will excite people a lot.
And that's the beauty of traveling, discovering of these small jewels, places that tourists don't go. We don't want to go anywhere anyway. Places, unique places, mom and pop places that are opening up their homes, their kitchens for you to to cater your local culinary delicacies, needs, what have you. So that's the beauty of traveling. That's what I love about it as well.
Yeah, and there, you know, those famous places certainly help sell tickets and get people excited, but I bet you they're most of the time not the most memorable of the, you know, the experiences that we have. It's the that whole sense of discovery, the authentic part side of where we're going, and uncovering that. And you know, when we travel in small groups too, it's that bonding that we make with a totally, you know, a stranger group coming together. So there's a lot of different influences there that really make the travel experience fun for us. It can be demanding. It can be challenging. And, you know, you always get slightly different personalities involved, maybe personalities you wouldn't quite pick to come with you. But that's part of the fun, too, is kind of seeing how you can figure out how to keep the group, you know, cohesive and not biting and scratching at each other.
Indeed, yes. That's how you get to know people.
Yeah.
When you travel with them.
Mm-hmm. For sure. That's what I told my wife. I said, hey, I travel with you well. I think we're going to stick together.
Good. Speaking of special dinners, you had an amazing, epic dinner last night. Mm. Please tell us about it.
Yeah, I can still feel it, taste it. I can hear it in my voice a little bit too. We spent some time collecting some really special bottles. I always try to grab things when I see it's the right wine that would excite me to taste, and I collect them up. And we created these concepts and behind the dinners where we taste basically three wines at a time, depending on how many people subscribe to the dinner. It could be 12 wines, 15 wines, 18 wines, 21 wines, about a bottle per person. And last night we produced a dinner called the Petrus dinner, and we were able to get some really great Petrus from various past vintages. And someone asked me last night, he goes, how are you going to top this? And I said, we're going to do Petrus dinner again with different vintages. That's how we're going to top it. And so, yeah, last night, though, I did my research, and you know, there were a number of criteria that came together for what wines I grabbed. But we tasted 66, 70, 71, 82, 2005, and 2012.
Wow.
Six wines from spanning that time to see how they, you know, what happens to the wine when it's, you know, close to 50 plus years old and 40 plus years old and, you know, 13 years old. And we had it at a Michelin star restaurant here in Los Angeles called Cali. And it was one of the best meals of the year. He got his Michelin star for a reason. He's very creative. It's not your normal experience there. They had like 70s dance songs on in the bar. I mean, it's really got a lot of personality at this place. And the team does a great job. The service was remarkable. And as I was telling you before we started recording, yesterday was a very significant biodynamic fruit day, which really elevated these wines. And everything was, I mean, when you put a dinner like this together, and by the way, we started off with a Magnum of 1999 Salon, and also Clos Casals 2013. So,
you know. It's a great vintage for the champagne, by the way.
Oh, yeah. And the Salon, I mean, I love Clos Casals. It's probably, if somebody asked me my favorite champagne, that's probably the one, because it's something I can actually afford to drink myself.
And it's available.
It's available. You don't have to clamor to get it if you know where to look. Whereas Salon is just so bespoke and so rare and, quite frankly, hideously expensive. But wow, was that a jaw-dropping wine. That was a wine that really could change the way you save money for wine spends. yeah, it was just magic and so good with the food. And yeah, so we had not only the Petrus and the champagne, but we had a white wine flight with our first or second course, and then a red wine flight that kind of took us through a bunch of different categories. We had a blind wine, and we had everybody try to guess. And then the entree, which was an aged beef course, with all six of the Petrus, and we took that into a, he calls it...
I'm salivating.
You oh, yeah. That, me, right? So am I. I can still taste it. There was a cheddar cheese. He called it Shades of Fiscalini, and it was like a cheddar dessert that was very inventive. Like I said, he really has some ideas that are pretty far outside of normal. And then we finished with the piece de resistance at Cali is his, he does, meringue, but what it is that it's the egg white meringue still in its liquid form, frozen. Mm. Then he shaves, so that's made from egg whites. Then he shaves candied egg yolks. I think they're fermented dry-aged egg yolks on top of it. That, and I when he said he was going to do that for dessert, I had in mind to share some Madeira, and we drank a 2001 Boual that was such a perfect pairing for that course. So yeah, it was really a good night. I was able to plan it so that my team service the dinner, and I really just got to enjoy it and talk, and you know, I didn't spit.
Of course not. So how did a 50-year-old Petrus taste? How did a 40-year-old Petrus taste, or a younger ones? Did you see the progression?
Yeah, evolution was there, but frankly, everyone was really taken aback by how fresh each of the wines were. Not like in a suspicious, were these real type of, you know, there was obvious progression. The 66 had this phenomenal, like I call them scars of age, and it had this kind of a whiff of, you know, really advanced, a large amount of advancement, I guess you would call it tertiary type of character. And it almost had like this, you know, the fruit had really kind of moved into that savory category. So the nose was, you didn't even need to drink it. I mean, it was just like something you wanted to sit and smell, this very advanced, you know, there was with a 100% Merlot, Petrus, 100% Merlot. You're going to move from the freshness of the 12th showcasing all that cherry skin and vanilla from the wood, and this almost fruit sweetness that you're going to get from a great producer growing Merlot on blue clay. And then as that wine progressed slowly because the 5, 2005, which may be the greatest Petrus ever made,
really
was it's a 100-point wine by like 7 reviewers and 20 out of 20 by Jancis, and so it was a $7,500 bottle.
Wow. Okay.
And it wears its. It wore the wood, and I think this is pretty common in 5. It wore the wood like a fur coat, so it has this kind of amazing protective, long aging shell that's slowly integrating, and it's really a sensation that you find with other great 2005 Bordeaux, but was really interesting in the mindset of a Petrus. And then go back to 1982, which I've had in multiple times, but I got this 1982 bottle from this private collector up in Northern California who was the original purchaser, and he had several wood boxes of 82 Petrus in his cellar. When I received that bottle, I had to question it because the fill line was so high. I'm like, oh my God, this bottle is beyond pristine. It's like, and you know, 82 is kind of legendarily counterfeited. So I was very suspicious and I talked to this guy, but the bottle was just so perfect. Opened the cork, everything. And I decanted that thing, double decanted it, and watched the room fall in love with that wine. Wow. Because it was so pure and in such an incredible spot. I think that is the poster child wine of Petrus, and why Petrus is so loved is the 82. But then you move into the tougher 1970, 71. 70 and 71 were very similar vintages in Bordeaux and often kind of battle out which one was better. And in a terms of 1970s vintages, those were really good years. But when I opened the 70, I decided not to decant it. It was kind of like screaming, drink me from the bottle. And so we poured it direct from the bottle without decantation or anything. And then the 71 had some extra gusto. And so I did double decant it, but we didn't pre-pour it. And the wines just showed so well, but they really had that advancement that the 82 hadn't yet even started to show. 82 hadn't even... you know, minimal advancement in the color, minimal. Whereas 70 and 71 had nice advancement, and the 66 really had a different tonality to the color. And that nose was really, you know, into that later stretch, but I wouldn't say it was peaked. In fact, if you look at pricing, you know, you're going to pay more for the current vintages probably than you would for those older 70s and before vintages, with the exception of 61. And yet, if you can go back even further, those get even rarer going back into like the 40s and stuff. Those become, you know, lifetime investments. And there's very few bottles back then still in existence. But really... was a remarkable showing for the wines, and I was very fortunate that there weren't any flaws or that I had to apologize for anything.
No cork taint.
My 70 cork was really soft, but it had this crazy amount of kind of cellar cheese on the top that I think was holding it together. Because when I pulled that cork out, it kind of came out without any. You know, if I pressed harder on the cork, I probably could have dropped it in the bottle. But, you know, that's just the different provenance of the different wines. And that's why old Bordeaux can be a bit of a gamble. And you have to know what to look for. And I always prioritize the status of the cork and the fill line. I would never buy a bottle that had any seepage or signs of past seepage, unless it was... you know, worth taking a risk because the price was so, right. So great. But, you know, for a dinner like this, you can't take those kind of chances. And so we were very fortunate.
That sounds like an amazing dinner last night.
it was ridiculous, and I'd say the duck that he presented last night, we did that with some great reds, including a Jamais Co Roti that was the perfect pairing for this duck with his duck sauce. And he had this great use of squash with the duck. And I never thought of that as a potential pairing. But wow, it was so good. And Kevin, Chef Kevin, he loves to forage. He's really pushes, you know, things into very, like with the beef, he wanted to showcase dry aged beef or wet aged beef, and it really took you into a category of beef that's quite decadent. And with the duck, his duck was super lean and edged on gamey, but he pulled it back with that squash and the sauce. And it just really connected nicely to the Co Roti.
Wonderful, wonderful experience for you and your guests, obviously. The reason we're recording this today is because you're going on a trip next week.
Yeah.
Tell us about that trip, please. Where are you going?
Yeah, so as soon as I recover from last night, I'll be packing, taking a group to Argentina.
Excellent. Wow, okay. Why Argentina? And what's the trip entail?
Yeah, so we have taken a group to Argentina before. So when we go back, we're always going to go back to different places and see different faces. But it had just been long enough that we hadn't been to Argentina. We wanted to see what's going on. And a friend of mine who I worked with at Cobran, Piero Anchisa del Roqueta, grew up, you know, at his family's winery in Tuscany. But he went to college in Malibu at Pepperdine. And so as I was starting my business with Learn About Wine, he was kind of coming in and coming to my events. I don't know if he was coming for the very attractive female clientele or to learn, but I think he was enjoying the scene. And we became good friends. And so now he has his own winery in Patagonia. And so I told him I was going to take a group to Argentina. He's like, bring them to my winery. It's way out in the middle of nowhere, but you can stay at our winery. There's four guest rooms, and you could have eight people there, and we'll take great care of you. And I said, done. So we built the whole trip with the idea of ending up in Patagonia. We have 12 total travelers, but not everybody's going to make it to Patagonia. That was kind of like the VIP extension mm-hmm. option, but we'll start off in Buenos Aires, go to Salta, which is, kind of the land less traveled, high altitude, one of the highest altitude vineyards in the world, Colomé, and we'll hit there. We'll do some horseback riding, some picnics, some vineyard trips, work with their winemaking team, learn about their Torrontés and their
high altitude. That's what they're known for over there, like, yeah, Torrontés.
Particularly successful with Torrontés, yeah. And it's supposed to be really visually stunning up there, high deserts. Very high altitude. It'll test our constitution, I think, a little bit, because mm-hmm. We have to travel pretty hard to get there. It's about a 4-hour drive after a 5:30 in the morning flight. Mm. So we'll arrive pretty whacked out by the time we get there. But we'll spend a couple of days in Salta. We'll head back down, transfer to Mendoza. And we'll see some rock star wineries in Mendoza. And of course, Argentina has the highest per capita consumption of beef. So it's usually a 7-course meat fest mm-hmm. where you start from the tail and end up at the tongue of the cow and eat the sweetbreads and the different asadas. Yeah, yeah. So we'll fatten up in Mendoza before we head back to Buenos Aires for a respite. And then we'll head down to Patagonia, and we'll do chakra, and then we're gonna a select group of those people are going to continue down to see the glaciers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So about 2.5 weeks.
Wow, that's a nice long trip.
It's a long trip.
Yes.
I'll be ready to come back.
I've been to Argentina. It's a beautiful country, amazing food, amazing wines, obviously. So it's going to be a great trip for you and your guests. You're going to have a great time there.
Yeah.
As you alluded to earlier, I remember you used to put on these large events here.
Yeah.
Throughout the whole year at big venues. With 500, 600, 700 people, sometimes even more attending. Are you still doing those or things have changed?
That's I like the way you asked that question because, yeah, we were at our full, you know, probably stride heading into the pandemic. But the wheels on the economy, for my economy, for the wine economy, for the world, people talk about how good the economy was in 2018, 2019. I don't think the wine economy was doing that well. And I really saw wineries running out of money and some things happening. And so we started to downshift a little bit just prior to the pandemic, to a point where I was pretty set on establishing a classroom location. And in all my wisdom, one of the great mistakes of my life is February of 2020, I signed a pretty massive lease for a classroom in the Arts District of downtown and never got to use that classroom. And so instead we turned it into like a wine shop with free delivery. But the events obviously went away. A lot of our top 100 customers took the pandemic to reposition their lives away from the hills of Hollywood and Bel Air and move to places like Arizona, Florida, Texas. I mean, inside of my top 100 customers, 60 of them disappeared.
Wow.
And you magnify that out over my entire database, which was about 25,000, and we woke up in 2003 with a database closer to 15,000. And so we've been trying to crawl our way back, but we're doing it a little differently, a little more intimate stuff. You know, when I work with James Suckling, we would have 1,000 people in the room because of James, but those were more his events that we helped produce. He's the mastermind behind that stuff, and he's a much bigger personality. My events today kind of target 150 people, 200 people at a time, whether it's 150 trade during the day and 150 to 200 people at night for the consumer. And that's kind of what I'm comfortable building in the city of Los Angeles at this time. So we are returning with those stars. We call them stars events. And we'll have a Stars of California at the end of November. We'll be doing that at Republique. And then Stars of Cabernet at the end of January. And we haven't signed the paperwork yet if it's going to be at the Peninsula or Mayborn or somewhere else.
I remember Suckling used to have events in L.A., big Italian wine events or French wine events. And the last time, I think the last one he did was pre-COVID. He stopped coming to L.A., I guess. Is it the L.A., the market here, the situation here, while he's having events in Miami or in New York, not in L.A.? Why do you think that is? Is that there's not that much demand for it, or he sees a bigger markets there?
I think both those. James is a really big personality, and he has incredible following in Miami and New York and Hong Kong. He lives in Hong Kong. And so those, I think those marketplaces, if you even look at, you know, kind of wine behavior and stuff too, they're a little bit more concentration of high tier wine collectors that kind of also going towards the direction of the wines that he reviews, whether it's Bordeaux or Italian wines. You know, in California, we drink Bordeaux and Italian wines, but we also drink a lot of California wine. And so the California wine thing is not something that he has yet championed. If he wanted to, I'm sure he could. And I'm sure at some point he'll return to Los Angeles. We have talked about it. Hopefully he'll come back and work with us. But he's become so, you know, his team has grown 10 times. And he might not even need my services next time he comes around. But he's always welcome to give me a call. And I stay in touch with him all the time. He's a good man.
Yeah, I met him a couple of times during these events in L.A. And he, great personality, as you said. I mean, he's the mastermind behind these events that with the ratings, his points, his reviews, phenomenal job he's done.
Amazing.
You talked about high-altitude wines. I just got back from Armenia 2 weeks ago.
All right.
And Armenia has the highest altitude vineyards. They go as high as 5,800 feet. And right now they're experimenting with the help of an EU agency on even higher altitude wines, where they have this one vineyard at about 6,200 mm-hmm. feet in elevation. Mm-hmm. They're testing different vines to see how the vines are going to react at this high altitude. So interesting things are happening. Maybe one day you can take your group to Armenia.
Hey, if you want to help me with that, what I look for is local expertise to help us. So when we go to Greece, we have a Ted Ladikas. I don't know if you know him. I love Greek wines.
Okay.
He helps us put the trip together. We go to Barolo. We have a young lady who lives in Barolo, and she helps us there. You know, so when we travel, we try to find someone locally that knows the marketplace. We have a gentleman who lives in London help us with Bordeaux. And that way, you know, it's not us trying to figure. The hardest part often on these trips is accommodations and transportation. And so those things, having that confidence in those two pieces allows you to build a beautiful trip. And then having the local expert, you know, that knows the great wineries that maybe are undiscovered or maybe, you know, can get you into the place that is already very famous, that really is helpful. Armenia is absolutely someplace. I love the wines of Armenia. I love what I've tasted and seen. I think it's an exciting opportunity for I mean, there's a very large Armenian population here. You might know that.
Yes, I do.
But I think it's a, you know, it's a region that has been making wine for as long as wine has been made, and I think I think it's really gotten to a point too where they've become much more market savvy. The packaging has improved. The you know, shipability, the way we ship wine has improved. So all these things have connected to allow Armenian wines to become a thing here.
Absolutely, and we're the largest retailer of Armenian wines in the U.S.
I bet.
Under the winesofarmenia.com platform, and we should talk about it. I was just there again, as I said, and we'll be happy to work with you, get something going.
Awesome.
We'll talk about it. That's wonderful. Good, I'm glad I got you there.
Yeah.
Is the wine, you talked about downsizing your event to smaller venues, smaller groups. Is that the norm right now because of the economy or post-COVID? Is that what's going to happen for the time being?
Yeah, you know, when you're producing a wine event, if you don't have a couple thousand people there, it's pretty difficult to get a sponsor. And wine events really only pencil with sponsorship. So I have to create a lot of benefits for the wineries to come. And they, you know, they pay a fee to be there. It's a fractional fee to what some of the bigger events in the country cost, but that's how we can pay the bill down, because these venues are pricey. Mm-hmm. You know, you could look at a $50,000 venue bill, and you can't actually monetize that back with the audience very well. So, you know, we have to create value for the audience and somehow pay that bill down. So it's a balancing act when you're building small events. So our events really are, you know, angling in a very high quality direction, really good food, really good service, really good locations. We encourage people to get dressed up. We raise some money for charity. And at the end of the day, my events aren't really that profitable, but they are very good for our business and for our city. And those are kind of some of the driving forces behind what I do, is I want to improve the quality of the population by introducing them to wines and ideas and personalities that if we just sit back and let the wine industry do it, it'll only be the very strong wineries that people learn about. You can see that happening in certain parts of the city. There are certain brands that some people just worship and they stop exploring, and that drives me crazy, to be honest. I could not imagine living in a world where I drank the same wine every day.
Me too.
And there's so many people that do that.
I know.
It's a wild. And to think that, I mean, that's a passionless pursuit. And so,
Of them drink wine that isn't that good.
Yes, we know what we're talking about.
Yes, we do.
But the excitement to me, if people ask me what's my favorite wine, probably it sounds coy and cliche, but my favorite wine is probably going to be the next wine I try, because I just love that sense of discovery. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be Chateau Petrus. I don't live in that world. I just get to visit it once in a while. And I think that's also, part of why I still love it, is because my own career allows me to experience stuff that I couldn't even afford to do myself.
And that's absolutely right. I mean, I have certain favorite regions, favorite wineries, but I'm always looking for the next wine I want to taste. I want mm-hmm. next wine I'm going to discover.
Yeah.
Next vintage, next region. So that's what makes it exciting.
Totally.
And that's why I love what I do also, because it's all about discovery. No two vintages are alike. No two winemakers are alike. No two vineyards are alike. So that's the whole point of wine, because you're a wine person. I'm a wine person. That's what I love about this thing.
Yeah.
And that's why I love doing this.
Yeah.
How is the wine scene in LA right now?
It's an interesting moment in the wine in LA's evolution. I think I'm very bullish about Los Angeles. I appreciate when people move away and they're like, say, oh, the traffic, all this stuff. I think LA is one of the greatest places in the world to live. I think it's a combination of the weather, the unbelievable saturation of stimulants that we have here, whether it's music, comedy, the beaches, the mountains, Hollywood, all these things, the confluence of things coming together makes LA special. And I've traveled the world and I can still say, I think LA is, for me, it's geared for me. It's where I want to be. And I think, that LA has cleaned up a lot. It has a long way to go. I don't think it'll ever be perfect, but I think, LA has cleaned up a lot. Those people that moved away, you got replaced by a much younger, smarter, tech savvy audience. They're more diverse. Ethnically, it's a more, the most diverse I've ever seen in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I think it, property values haven't dropped. So incomes have definitely risen. I think other beverages, scotch, great beer, certainly the marijuana industry, they all have a bigger slice of the pie than we would probably like in the wine business. But there's a kind of a cycle. I think wine keeps getting better, and wine will eventually get better again to a point where it pulls people away. Either that, or they'll wake up and they're like, oh, all this beer is making me fat. I better go to wine. And as that population, that seeds LA right now matures, I think that's a cycle too. You start off with beer and spirits, and that's, you know, bartenders are still inventing amazing cocktails. Everyone right now is drinking espresso martinis. So wine's getting a little bit of a back seat for a moment, but it's going to come back with a vengeance eventually. And I think the LA is, you know, we can talk about the statistics. You know, I think they say like state of California is one of the top five economies in the world. And I think LA is number 10. So we drink a lot of wine from all over the world. That's another great thing about LA is that we drink Oregon Pinot. We drink, you know, Bordeaux, Chilean,
Armenian.
We have it all. And then we have a restaurant culture that's been radically changing. And we've got this natural wine movement happening, which I call the tail of the dog, because I really think it's going to influence the big wineries to change in a good way. I think the natural wine thing is something that we all saw coming. I think a lot of people wish it would go away. I think a lot of people love it. I think it's the kind of the economic value side of wine right now too, because these wines are coming in at a price point that people can afford, this young restaurant population. So it's pretty dynamic. I do fear that some of our favorite areas of the world have maybe gotten to a price point stretched out, that it's kind of like an alternative wine marketplace right now. I'll use the example of Champagne. Probably prices have gone up 30%, right? Maybe some even 50% since, I'll say 5 years ago. And so people look at the Champagne price and they're like, I don't want to pay $300 for a bottle I used to pay $160 for. So they're going to find alternatives. And the same thing happens with like Veuve Clicquot, which is now an $80 bottle of wine. They're going to find alternatives, or you know, what they used to pay for Veuve Clicquot, $39.95. And so new things are being discovered, new opportunities. And as that elasticity stretches the marketplace, new things can come in, take share. Maybe they're not as good as Veuve was. And so that's why I think wine is kind of in that moment where it's stretched out financially, and it kind of, we need a way for the customer to come back up to these wines, or those wines come back down to the customer. And I think that's where wine is in LA right now.
You know, you alluded to this earlier about the natural wine, organic wine movement that's really growing exponentially. It's growing about 12% a year, whereas legacy wines, shall we call them, are growing about 2.5 to 3% a year.
I believe it.
That's where the growth is coming from. That's where the new wine drinkers are, younger people,
yeah.
21 to 40.
We need those.
Absolutely. So that's where the growth is coming from. Interestingly, when I was telling you about my trip last year to Burgundy and to Barolo, most of those vineyards there are either certified organic or they're practicing organic, but they don't have the certification. Yet that's not something they announced to their wine consumers, because the people who are drinking the Barolo or the Burgundy are not necessarily looking for an organic seal. They want their traditional big Barolos and Burgundies, so that's not something for them to market to their customers. Yet they are practicing because they want to be good to the soil, they want to be good to the environment, they want to be good to themselves,
sure,
for their families who work the fields.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the growth is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I see some things happening in California as well.
Absolutely.
So that's very good. Yeah. How's the restaurant scene in LA these days?
I think it's in the same type of status. You've got some big restaurants closing.
Mm-hmm.
You have some smaller ideas opening. I think you'll have kind of a pyramidal effect where the top restaurants, they might get a little top heavy, you know, those big iconic heavy restaurants,
mm-hmm.
they might get a little top heavy, too much capital to keep those doors open, and keep the volumes up to pay those big rents. So I think the way we're reacting on the food scene is smaller very specialized restaurants. And that's where a lot of those natural wine lists are kind of stemming from. And I think there's a lot of innovation. You know, when the economy is pressed, you start seeing a lot of interesting new ideas, you know, with food, alternative cuts of meat or maybe non-meat. You have, you know, a proliferation of tacos. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just a value. It's a value. So I think it's a challenging state for restaurants to be in. I do think there are restaurants that are making more money than they've ever made. I think there are restaurants that used to make a lot of money that don't make any money anymore. And I think the restaurant industry has always been kind of like natural selection. And the strongest survive, and the weakest get removed. Right. And I think in these times where you have, you know, this large surge in payroll, because you couldn't find a dishwasher, probably in a restaurant environment a couple of years ago, the dishwasher was one of the best paid employees. And that has changed and moved around.
Now with the high wages as well.
Yeah, now you're going to have a higher average wage. I think they're talking about a $25 wage. Yeah. And tips and people getting a little frustrated by the tipping and the tipping plus the 4% plus the 3% plus the this, that. It makes everything a little more expensive. So I think we're just in this ingestive period where, you know, it will be a challenge for a while, but incomes will rise. Some price pressure might come back down a little bit. I doubt it, but a little bit. And I think we'll just all kind of realize where we're at. And then when that happens, I think what we'll see is some pretty amazing restaurants, new ideas. Actually, if you were to travel around with me in LA, there are green shoots everywhere. There's things that are happening, you know, Japanese ice cream bars coming in,
really?
You know, from milk imported from Japan, you know, you've got little teeny operations, very specialized, but they're going to change what we eat, how we eat. We still have, you know, all this abundance here in Southern California of great produce. And I predict by next summer, we're all going to be talking about this new wave of energy that's coming through California anyway. And I hope it proliferates across the country because we all deserve it.
You know, I love taking my own wines with me to restaurants, and I have no problem paying the corkage.
100% with you.
Is this something you do? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I'm passionate about it. And I think restaurants are making a big mistake not encouraging people like you and me to bring wine. And for anybody, restaurants that are listening, think about it. You know, we probably eat out more than the normal people, right?
Yes.
So we go probably to the same places often because they're wine friendly.
Correct. You're so right there. Absolutely.
Right. And if you're not wine friendly, we're not probably going there.
Mm-hmm.
So restaurants almost get punitive with corkage fees sometimes. And if you don't have a corkage fee, you're basically telling us you don't want us there because your wine program is established on these multiples. And the type of wine we like to drink all of a sudden becomes such a large investment.
Especially being in the wine business.
Yeah.
I don't want to pay that fee.
Right. Yeah, you know, you can buy a wine at retail for $100, but on a wine list, it's going to be $250 to $300.
Well, I can buy the wine wholesale.
Yes, exactly. And so we are spoiled in that way, but we should be encouraged to be going out to these restaurants. And so restaurants need to get smarter about how to encourage people. Use wine as a marketing hook to get us to come in, because there are lots of well-financed people with wine in the hills here in Los Angeles. So much wine. I mean, that is maybe another issue for the wine industry, is that the wine collectors are all talking about how they own too much wine. And so the reality is you should be a restaurant that is saying, hey, people with a lot of wine in your cellar, I want you to bring your great wines to my restaurant. Maybe a corkage fee, I mean, a $50 corkage fee, quite honestly, I'm okay.
Depends on the restaurant.
Right. You have good glasses. You have
That's
good,
key. Yeah.
Great
Don't
food.
Give me this $5 glasses.
Sure. I agree. $50, that's a lot. There are restaurants, though, $100 corkage. They charge $50 for the first one, $100. If I'm going out to dinner with four people, we probably want to bring four bottles. Let us bring four bottles. It's not going to hurt your bottom line. We are probably going to be coming back there with frequency. And and then you could also get creative and say, hey, buy a bottle, I'll waive a corkage fee. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that that was the best idea for a group like us. And so I think restaurants need to, kind of drop. I think that this is like a Vegas, New York thing, and a lot of restaurateurs end up in LA from those marketplaces, and they bring that idea with them. Not in California. This is where a city where people are on mailing lists and buy wine from direct from wineries, et cetera. We have these things that auto ship to our house. We don't have cellars that are generational cellars. We have drinking cellars, and we want to take our bottles out. So I think the restaurants in Southern California, everywhere, really ought to cater to the probably the highest end food and beverage customer that there is in Los Angeles has too much wine in their house. Get them to bring their wine.
I hear that from a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not even drinking. They tell me I'm not even drinking what I have.
Right.
And that's common. I have that same problem myself.
It's crazy. Because when you go to a restaurant, you're probably bringing a bag, right? Full of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. And so probably a lot of your friends are doing the same thing.
No, actually, I take the wine. They just show up.
Okay. Well, I'm guilty of that too. I'm actually kind of like, I encourage my friends.
Which I'm happy to do, by the way.
Yes, I know you. I know I'm with you because your friends don't bring the kind of wine that you want to drink.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And we get to say, hey, let me show you something.
And I have no problem sharing with my friends.
Yeah.
I love the experience.
That's what
and
we love.
That's the whole wine is all about. You want to share the experience.
Yeah,
I know you said that you don't have a favorite wine per se, depending on what's going to be drinking next. Where are some of your favorite wine regions?
Okay, so I will just give you what I'm currently thinking, because you asked me in 6 months from now, my answer might vary. But I absolutely still think champagne is the greatest beverage on the planet, and. If you're inviting me out for dinner or I'm going out someplace, I'm probably bringing a bottle of champagne. And also because if I'm going to a restaurant that allows corkage, I'm probably bringing a bottle of champagne because champagne is so overpriced in restaurants. Mm-hmm. And then if I did have to buy a wine, I'm probably going to buy a white wine off a restaurant wine list. But I drink more white than I do red. I'm a little weird that way. I like red wine, but I think white wine has more application. And so some of my favorites right now, I'm really loving the Mencia, Berisco type of wines from Spain. I love Beaujolais. By the way, you're going to see a theme here. A little less is more for me. I don't need big, massive, overripe things.
I know that about you, actually. We've had this conversation a few years back.
Yeah. And I haven't changed that much, but I really love finding the pleasure of something a little lighter and with more energy. And so I find those type of wines. I drink a lot of Chablis. I drink a lot of Albarino. I drink a lot of white, bright, crispy wines, and then the special occasion reds.
On that point though, how has your taste bud changed or evolved over time? I used to love the Napa Valley Cabernets.
Sure.
Not anymore.
Okay.
I don't drink those anymore. Okay. How has your taste buds evolved over time?
Well, I still love Napa Valley Cabernets, but I think that they are, I mean, Napa Valley is making such tremendous wines, and there's so many that I love, but I think I do try to keep a balance of drinking New World and Old World. Probably my favorite grape right now, because I'm a little contrarian too. You know, I make Zinfandel.
Yeah, I know.
But I'm a little contrarian, and my favorite grape right now, I've returned to love Sangiovese. Hmm. And I am finding a lot of innovation in Tuscan Sangiovese, a lot of vineyards in the Chianti zone that are not calling it Chianti, that are making some really delicious, beautiful, and a lot of them are natural wine inspired.
Are these blends?
They're pretty pure Sangiovese plays. And so
are they trying to get away from the Chianti label?
Maybe a little bit of that, but I think where they need to avoid the Chianti label because it has such litigious implications. And so they can make a Sangiovese in Tuscany for, you know, and come in around $20-$25 that might, you know, challenge stuff like Rosso, the Montalcino, and little singular vineyards throughout Chianti. They've kind of risen up. And it's price point driven, it's quality driven, and plus Tuscany's had some really good vintages, in a row, and so I think that is a spot where you're going to find me shopping more than I have ever before.
Interesting, very good. Well, Ian, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate this conversation. It was a lot of fun. We should do it again.
Flew by.
Indeed. Thank you again. I learned a lot. I'm sure our audience learned a lot as well. And remember, always drink the good stuff. Cheers, everybody.